supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. A Philadelphia judge sentences two brothers to life in prison without the chance for parole for fatally shooting a city police officer in 2015. WHYY's Aaron Moselle reports that the sentence drew sharp criticism.
Ramon Williams and Carlton Hipps pleaded guilty to killing Sergeant Robert Wilson III as he tried to stop them from robbing a video game store in North Philly. Wilson was on duty that snowy day and was grabbing a gift for his son when Williams and Hipps entered the shop. The deal means both men will spend the rest of their lives in prison, but avoid the death penalty. Philadelphia's new district attorney Larry Krasner has vowed not to pursue a death sentence in any case and explained that decision after the sentencing.
People who get a death sentence in Pennsylvania die of natural causes in custody. And they do that whether they have a sentence of death by incarceration, which is life without the possibility of parole, or they have a sentence of death. It's the same outcome.
Krasner says a big part of his office's decision was based on what the mothers of Wilson's children wanted. But not everyone wanted the case to end this way. In court, several family members and friends, many of them officers, decried the decision during emotional statements to the judge and the brothers. Shakira Wilson Burroughs, Wilson's sister, told reporters her brother deserves better.
I can't say that I'm disappointed. You can only be disappointed in someone that you know cares, respects, values, and supports you. I'm disgusted.
Police Commissioner Richard Ross echoed those sentiments during the same impromptu press conference.
I thought this was a death penalty case. If there ever was one, this would be it.
As part of their deals, Williams and Hipps are prohibited from appealing. This was the first big test for DA Krasner's promise not to seek capital punishment, and he got considerable pushback. Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
The way EPA Chief Scott Pruitt handled water contamination standards has a local Republican congressman calling on him to quit.
I'm opposed to these knee-jerk reactions to calling for people's resignation. What I always believe in is a full Inspector General investigation and report, have those findings of fact and conclusions of law presented to Congress, and then we make a recommendation. That's the most orderly way to do it, but I will say with this man, there is way too much smoke surrounding him.
That's Bucks County Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick, who adds he's upset with Pruitt's response to another federal agency releasing a study calling for much tougher standards for water contamination regarding the chemicals PFOS and PFOA. They were used in firefighting foams as well as in consumer products, including Teflon. Standards in a report from the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry were 7 to 10 times tougher than those recommended by the EPA. Fitzpatrick accuses Pruitt of trying to keep that stronger standard from Congress and the public. Speaking in Horsham today, Fitzpatrick was joined by Democratic Congressman Brendan Boyle, who says details of the report speak for themselves.
When emails came out showing that White House and EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt were suppressing a damning federal health study for fear of a, quote, public relations nightmare, I led a bipartisan letter with Mr. Fitzpatrick calling for the study's release. Now that the study has been released, we see what Mr. Pruitt was afraid of.
Water wells in areas near current and former military installations in Bucks and Montgomery counties have tested positive for the chemicals. Recent reports show higher than normal cancer rates for those served by the contaminated water systems.
Do they think of me now in those strange Asian villages where nothing ever seemed quite human but myself and my few grim friends moving through them, hunched in lines? When they tell stories to their children of the evil that awaits misbehavior, is it me they conjure?
That was poet, teacher, and Vietnam veteran Bill Earhart reading his poem, Making the Children Behave, at a reading yesterday in Philadelphia. Good writing often has its roots in trauma, and for Americans who served in the Vietnam War, It's sometimes hard to separate personal trauma from their anger at the government that sent them to a war they felt or came to feel was unjust. NewsWorks Tonight producer Shai Ben-Yaakov spoke with several veterans about their poetry, excerpted in a book, A Shadow on Our Hearts, Soldier, Poetry, Morality, and the American War in Vietnam. Shai started out by asking poet and veteran Lamont B. Steptoe, who is black, about the role of race during the war.
Our interactions with the Vietnamese people were mostly on two levels. Well, three levels. One, either as the enemy. Two, as prostitutes. And three, as the ones who shined our boots and did our laundry. And my first week there, one of the women, her name was Lynn, L-I-N, and she looks at me and she says, you same monkey. I said, what? She said, you same monkey. You know, and of course you can imagine what my response was. But and some of them would even walk behind black soldiers to see if we had a tail. Now, where were they getting this? A lot of times they were being told this by white soldiers, racist white soldiers, you know. But that was the first time a Vietnamese person looked at me and said, you same monkey.
What role do you think the environment, some of the poetry deals with the otherness of the environment itself? Did that, you know, also play a role in your poetry?
Almost anywhere you're going to be is going to be the other. You know, being operating in areas that were largely rice farming, you know, a very, very rudimentary agricultural and fishing environment, the place stank. I remember my very first thought was, Jesus, these people stink. This place, they don't even smell like human beings. And I was shocked by my own reaction, but that's the way it turns out I'm the one who stinks. They could smell me a mile away. You learn to not use soap and stuff because otherwise the VC knew you were out there. So it was alien. On the other hand, I think it's less alien environment than it is the alien nature of being in a war.
Jan, I think you do sometimes do talks. Do you ever talk to Iraq and Afghanistan veterans? Have you ever had any interaction with them?
I do, primarily through writing workshops that I've either participated in and or coordinated. War is such chaos. We're imposing a storyline. And one of the things that I think poetry helps with is you find one little tiny thread of it. And if you piece enough of these threads together, it's like you sort of start to see a little bit of a mosaic of what your own experience was. But this concept that there's this history of each war, and that's the way it was for all soldiers, is what we all had to work against, that everybody else assumes what our experiences were.
Interestingly enough, in 1995, I was studying at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem because witnessing in the Holocaust is, and the poetry that comes out of that is similar to this in what it does. And as part of that trip, I tried to make time to speak with Israeli veterans, both male and female, because it was just convenient to do. And I discovered that, lo and behold, it was exactly the same story with these kids on doing their reserve duty up on the Lebanon border or on the Golan Heights, and they had the same stories. What a surprise. And they were just as bitter and just as funny and just as pissed off as everybody else was.
So I'm not a veteran. I've never served in the military. And I just want to ask, you know, anybody who wants to answer, what is something that you hear frequently or that you feel that people who didn't have this experience misunderstand about it? What would you want to tell them?
I often get, welcome home. I just got it the other day. Like, what makes these people think I'm home? Because I tie my shoes and I don't drool? And then the other one is, thank you for your service. I went halfway around the world to kill, maim, and make miserable people who'd never done me or my country any harm, nor ever would or could. If you want to thank me for that, you should go talk to your priest.
The problem for me is that all of those memorials and, you know, and ticker tape parades and all of that and all of those things that were happening in the early 80s were actually part of a concerted effort to change the whole dialogue about Vietnam. So it became not don't send American troops for worthless causes, it became support the troops. So now even you hear very, you know, well-meaning anti-war people who feel like they have to preface every sentence as, well, I support the troops, but, you know? And, you know, my question is, how do you support the troops without supporting the cause that they're fighting in? You know, how do you separate those two?
I guess because of my aging, I weep a lot, especially when it comes to talking about Vietnam. It doesn't take much to, you know, I mean, I realize it's going to be this way for the rest of whatever time I have left. I have to live with a deep, deep sorrow when I think about how my youth ended in Vietnam.
A team of scientists from around the world now convening in Philadelphia is hoping to peer all the way back in time and space. Joining me to learn more about the scope of the project is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, what sort of telescope would take us all the way back to the beginning?
It's unlike any other telescope you've ever seen before, I'm sure. In fact, if you were to see it, you might not even recognize it as a telescope, except that it points up, and that's a good start. But we have with us today a small team from the research group that's using this telescope that hopes to be able to discover new information about the very earliest time of the universe. And so joining us here in the studio today, we have Jack Orlowski-Scherer, Renee Elajek, and we have Casey Wagner, all part of that same team. Welcome, folks. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Our pleasure. We're glad you could be here. Now, while we understand that you're here in Philadelphia, as Dave said, to meet with everybody that's on your team working on this particular telescope of the Simons Observatory, I wonder if you could take a minute just to tell us about that project.
Sure. The Simons Observatory is a really ambitious project, bringing people from all around the world together to work on the designing and actually building this telescope in the deserts of northern Chile, in the Atacama, to try and understand what the universe was like really in its infancy and how it changes with time. There's a lot we still don't understand, and that's why it's so exciting. We don't know exactly what the conditions were at this inflationary time, this very early time, and so we're looking for signs and signals of particular types of physics that can happen, which makes it so exciting.
Jack, what does she mean by inflation?
Inflation is a period in the very early universe where the fabric of space-time expanded exponentially fast. That theory would solve many problems that we have in astronomy, but we don't have any direct validation of the theory of inflation yet.
Casey, would it, though, create other problems in the course of solving many?
I don't know how to answer that without making some people mad and making some people happy, I guess.
Oh, that sounds good. Let's do that.
No, I don't know all of the issues that could or could not be solved, but what I do know is that as Simons Observatory, we want to go out and make the best measurement we can to let people try and interpret that data and build their theories or refine their understanding based on the data that we have from these good measurements.
From what Derek has taught me, that's spoken like a true scientist.
Well, but it's actually, you know, Casey has a great point because it's really bringing together people who do very different things. You know, I don't work on the actual hardware or the detectors, but I'm very interested in saying, okay, what can the new measurement tell me about theories of dark matter? And so we play this dance together where I say the measurements have to be this precise, otherwise I can't tell the difference between two types of dark matter. And Casey says, well, okay, but actually we can only get the detectors so cold, so how can you do? And so as we start building the telescope, it's really about the theorists and the experimental scientists working hand in hand so that we don't just get something that nobody ordered.
To me, the most interesting thing is really coming as close as we can to finding out about this period of inflation. That's the thing that to me is really the coolest thing for me personally.
And again, this period of inflation was merely a fraction of a second?
A fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a second.
Were the rules as we know them even in place then?
So actually, the elements as we know them then were not in existence. So by the time the universe was a couple of minutes old, we had synthesized a lot of these nuclei, so a lot of the light elements, as we call them. We think that the laws of physics hold, and that's sort of a fundamental assumption. So that's sort of these ripples of inflation that we want to detect.
This is all fantastic research. It's just fabulous that you're probing these deep recesses of the universe in a very, very early time. What does that mean to the person out on the street? What does that mean to a kid growing up these days?
Well, all of these large, large data sets and developing the models to try to understand them, you know, the statistical models to understand these and analyze the data, well, this is the same kind of thing that Facebook is doing or that finance companies are doing. The tools and skills that we're developing to understand the early universe, those tools are kind of make their way into society in ways that are not transparent always, but that's one particular way.
We've learned so much more about the universe than when I started, and I can just wait and wonder to see what young scientists are going to show me as I get older in this field. It's really, really exciting.
I'm Jack Golowski-Scher. I'm a grad student at the University of Pennsylvania, and I'm from New Brunswick, New Jersey. I live here in Philadelphia now.
I'm Casey Wagner. I'm a lecturer of physics at Princeton University.
I am Renee Hlojek. I'm an assistant professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the Dunlap Institute and the Department of Astronomy at the University of Toronto in Canada. But I'm originally from South Africa, where the skies are cool and upside down.
Derek Pitts, thank you so much for bringing this cohort in to try to make sense of a very early time in our history.
My pleasure, Dave. There's a tremendous amount of astronomy, intellectual horsepower here, and I think it's great if Philadelphians can know and share that information.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Breck Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.